Hi everyone, and welcome to Paw Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comic book, manga, graphic novel, graphic literature podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Mick.
Hello.
And the other Rob.
I want to be referred to as Robert, if only if I could say it in the way that Bob Mortimer does in his Alderman sketches on his podcast in question, but I can't, so I think I'll just be Rob instead.
Robert?
Robert?
There we go.
Today we got something a little bit special because the new Marvel movie is out and everyone obviously knows what that is. But we'll get to that in a bit. But first up, we've got some news. Now, Alex Garland wrote the script for the 2012 film Dread, and he's also the writer-director for the new film Annihilation. He's thrown his name straight into the hat without being asked in order to basically make the Swamp Thing movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Can anybody else, I think it was Swamp Thing, sorry, but there was a version, a movie in the 1980s done by Wes Craven.
Am
I remembering that correctly, Anna?
I can't remember.
There was a Swamp Thing movie in that time.
There was, but I can't remember whether it was.
I'm pretty sure it was Wes Craven, because I remember watching it on TV when I was really young, and it was only in, you know, like coming back as an adult, looking into the, like, Wes Craven filmography and thinking, hang on, did he do that Swamp Thing? My word.
1982, Wes Craven.
It was a bad film. But I don't think it's a character that really works on the big screen, really.
I don't know.
Sort of like a Warner Brothers style horror movie from like the 1930s, 1940s era.
See, if they did Swamp Thing as kind of a TV series in the way of, say, Channel Zero or Stranger Things, I think that is something that could work. You know, but instead of having... because if you flip it, so it's instead of having the kids being hunted by the big bad or whatever, you have the big bad, in this case Swamp Thing, and he's the one who's trying to protect the, you know, these people in this area of nature around him from other big bads.
Yeah, the way you're saying it there is it's going to have like this bit like G.I. Joe at the end of the episode saying, remember kids, littering is bad. And then he puts his thumb up.
No, that's He-Man. You're thinking of He-Man. You're thinking of He-Man.
Well, yeah, but looping right back around the opening thing, is a Swamp Thing movie happening and Alex Garland is interested in directing? Or is it just Alex Garland fancies having a go at something unpromoted?
It appears to be Alex Garland just wants to do it.
Yeah, it looks like Alex Garland has just gone, Swamp Thing, nobody's touched Swamp Thing, nobody wants to touch Swamp Thing, I'll have that. I'll have a piece of that.
Interesting characters.
Sorry?
Well, I mean, the nearest thing there was to a Swamp Thing movie was a Justice League Dark movie.
Yeah.
Which is allegedly stalled.
Yeah, but I mean, I saw the Justice League Dark animated movie. And that was a joke and a half, to be fair. That was well below DC's normal standards.
But I'm pretty sure that Guillermo del Toro, director behind Shape of Water, Hellboy, and all sorts of other stuff, has wanted to do a Justice League Dark movie. And I think that's the best place for Swamp Thing, really, as part of an ensemble, rather than front and centre.
Yeah, although I have to admit, I haven't seen Shape of Water yet, but just from the trailers, I treat it as Abe Sapien gets laid.
Lots of people have, Rob. You're not the first one to come up with that one.
I know I wasn't the first one, but I know there'll be plenty more jokes like that. But
isn't that kind of derivative for the Guillermo del Toro, though? Because isn't that kind of a major plot arc in the second Hellboy movie? If Sapien wants to get his end away.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up with him and Hellboy singing, getting drunk and singing Can't Live Without You.
Yeah, underrated movie, that one.
Yeah, I think it's a really fun movie. But anyway, back to Swamp Thing. What do you think, Mick? Another Swamp Thing movie, could it work?
Couldn't care less.
Not a fan.
It's not a character I've ever really had any sort of affection for. You know, it's one of those fringe characters. I think for me, Swamp Thing is one of those characters that had a resonance at a certain point, and there's a reason why no one's hankering after a Captain Planet movie.
Yeah, because... I mean, the 1982 Swamp Thing, wasn't that... it's true. Wasn't the 1982 Swamp Thing, though, wasn't that around the time of, say, the Toxic Avenger movies and stuff like that?
Yeah, and it was a zeitgeist that was captured. At the time, your run-of-the-mill Joe Around Town wasn't as aware of the impact of environmental problems. So they used comic book characters, movies, cartoons, etc., to sort of beat the message home with all the subtlety of a mallet.
Yeah, true.
Now we live in a world where, you know, you can't look at a Facebook feed or a news bulletin without there being some mention of something to do with the environment or ecology. Yeah. People are aware of it now. It lacks its message, and therefore it just becomes another bad guy versus good guy movie.
It's still a message worth being made, but I think you've got to be a bit more intelligent about it than a character like Swamp Thing will allow.
The difference is that we've moved on. When in the 80s you had things like Captain Planet and the Swamp Thing and the Toxic Avenger, it was about making sure people knew there was a problem. We all know there's a problem now, unless you're Donald Trump. What we need to do now is start making films that offer potential solutions or look at how we can be clever about finding solutions. You know, that's
feeling that.
And
movies that are just really cool, you know. And I don't think Swamp Thing has that ability to be cool. She's not a cool character.
This is true.
I mean, in terms of getting that message around about trying to find solutions, downsizing, for all the fact that it's a ham-fisted attempt at doing it, is the kind of movie you should be doing. How are we going to cope with overpopulation? Well, let's look at this method.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm not sure why this whole flag for Swamp Thing has been raised. You know, maybe Alex Garland just really likes the character, which, you know.
Well, Edgar Wright did the same thing with Ant-Man, and that actually crystallized into something which was eventually taken away from him. So maybe, who knows?
It might be. Moving on to Mr. Brian Michael Bendis. Yes.
A favourite of the show.
Yes.
Has he wrote another 100 series of Spider-Man? Is that what he's done?
No, he's been hired by 20th Century Fox to script a movie about Kitty Pryde. Not about the X-Men, just about Kitty Pryde.
Why?
That's the question I'm asking as well.
Well,
of all the X-Men, they have done Wolverine to death, and Gambit stuck in development hell, development limbo, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, Kitty Pryde is currently the leader.
It's much more interesting characters than that.
I don't know. Actually, thinking about it, I can kind of see where they're coming from. Kitty Pryde is the current leader of the X-Men. She used to lead Excalibur as well. Oh, she was Excalibur. She's the current leader of the X-Men.
She's the current leader of the X-Men?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Before we discuss this too much and take up too much of our precious listeners' time, we've got to bear in mind that anything that 20th Century Fox slate now for Marvel characters
might not
has got to be treated with some scepticism as to whether it's going to have a future.
Well, this is the thing. This is news.
Unless we forget, though, Fox, Mick has made this remark on the show a few times, but if you remove Logan from their collection of movies, I couldn't tell you what happens in what movie in what. Stuff happens in X-Men movies.
I suspect that when the New Mutants hits screens and has its new horror angle, we'll probably be in pretty much the same situation, but we'll remember that one as being the one where the lights were switched off.
I don't know.
New
Mutants has got a 10-month delay, doesn't it?
Well, is that any wonder considering that, you know, during that 10 months, the fair trade committees around the media industry are looking to the validity of the Disney-Marvel takeover of Fox. If that happens, anything they're doing with Marvel properties is going to be fair game. So most things are going to get put on hold. Most things aren't going to get much past the pre-production stage.
This is true.
Well, the stuff that's already in development, later on in development at least.
I mean, unless there's actually sort of people in front of cameras, you can pretty much guarantee that they'll all get put on hold, at the very least get put on hold, and if not, completely cancelled until Marvel decide what they're going to do with their properties now they've gotten back.
Yeah. The thing is, I can understand if you put all the Marvel Fox business to one side, or Disney Fox business to one side, I can understand why they've kind of gone for Kitty Pryde right now.
She is popular.
She's popular. Kind of. I think what they're trying to do is kind of capitalize on the popularity of characters like Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl. and
sort of internet popular.
Yeah,
you've also got to bear in mind that some of the better known characters in the X-Men stable, like Storm and Mystique and people like that, they're being played on screen by actors that are in demand and probably aren't keen to engage in a new franchise.
Yeah, but I mean, the other angle as well, though, if they did a movie about Storm, people would just turn around and say, oh, they're basically just copying Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
You know, whereas they've not done anything with a young teenage female mutant character, so Kitty Pryde fits that bill totally.
Yeah, but I don't think Bendis is the right person for it.
Well, he's written a lot of...
Because that'll be a 100-film epic.
He's actually written a lot of the Kitty Pryde comics.
Yeah, no, he's a bit too much in love with the character. You want somebody with fresh eyes.
Yeah, yeah. If you get someone who's written a lot of the comics, what you'll get is a very religious, strict adaptation of the comics to the movies.
True.
And not to bring up Guillermo del Toro again, but when you had like the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, talk of Guillermo del Toro doing The Hobbit, and that never came to fruition, and it was handed back to Peter Jackson again to do another trilogy, people were like, eh, again, I suppose so. And
not only that,
but to a point where what else can that person do in that world? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean that made no sense anyway. Having a trilogy out of a book that was a third the length of the first volume of Lord of the Rings.
No.
And yet you get the same amount of movie out of it.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, there's a whole 12 pages of The Hobbit, an entire 12-page section, which could have been literally summed into just two words: they travelled. 12 pages.
Montages are a thing, Peter Jackson. Montages are a thing.
Yeah, you don't need to, you know, put every dump that they have behind a tree on film.
Yeah. So anyway, speaking of something a little bit more positive, I think.
Yes.
Black Panther.
Yes.
It's kind of...
it's a movie.
It's a big movie, and it's kind of the big thing of this week's episode of Four Panel.
Yes. Yes, it is. But, you know, you guys have seen it, so go.
Good, wasn't it?
It was very good. I do have one slight concern.
Which is?
I have a slight concern that the hype that surrounded it, you know, last week we covered that just before we recorded the show, there was an article on the BBC News about the cultural impact of Black Panther, the movie.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. I think that kind of pre-hype, and don't get me wrong, I'm not going to denigrate from the fact that it is a cultural milestone, you know, black director, predominantly black cast in a multi-million dollar budget movie. It is a cultural milestone.
Yes.
But I think people might be expecting something a little bit more grandiose than it actually is. What you've actually got is a really well-executed Marvel movie.
Yeah, it's not substantial. It's not the most substantial of Marvel movies, but I think it's one of the better ones for some really sneaky reasons.
Yeah,
it's a Marvel movie, which has like a sense of self-awareness.
Yeah.
And what I mean when I say that is you look at the other Marvel movies and it's just destruction, destruction, destruction. And in this one, there's a greater sense of they do know the sense of history about what's going on, they know their place and their role in the world. Because... light spoiler here, but there's a moment
in the final battle.
Rifters looks at what's happened and looks who's fighting who and what they're doing to each other. And instead of thinking, I'm going to pursue this further, he just puts his weapons down and submits. And I think that's what I mean when I say a level of self-awareness, which just isn't in a Marvel movie.
I think the other thing that this film has, which every other Marvel movie, and indeed every movie in the world would be improved by, is the inclusion of battle rhinos.
Rhinos. What the hell? Are we talking rhinos covered in armor? Or are we talking like mech?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about, Rob.
Okay.
Imagine 12 angry men, 5 minutes before the judgment is made, in burst 2 angry battle rhino. Completely different film.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Actually, that would make it more interesting.
Citizen Kane.
So, yeah, it'd make more
sense. I was going to say, you're saying Rosebud was a battle rhino.
No, just as you focus on Rosebud and find out what Rosebud is, it gets smashed to pieces by two angry battle rhino.
I've got to say like a little bit about the villain of this as well.
Killmonger. Eric Killmonger.
Yeah, Killmonger.
Well, there's two villains, isn't there?
Rival, the other villain. I mean, the other villain is Manip. Called that because it has racist connotations.
Yeah. But, I mean, I thought the other villain was supposed to be Ulysses Claw.
Ulysses Claw is more of a conduit to the bad guy.
Okay.
He's the interim bad guy, just until the real bad guy gets there.
Yeah, he's like the caretaker bad guy. He's like the bad guy who's got the role until they appoint a permanent bad guy.
Or until somebody finds a suit where they can do motion capture for Andy Serkis.
Yeah, he's really good, though, by the way, Andy Serkis, but I think he's just one of those actors who just gives everything in any role he's in. Killmonger's good because they've made his character have a little bit more substance. You know, I mean, this movie about sins of the father inherited by the son, and that arc is played out really well, I think. And Eric Killmonger, he's up there with Loki and, Loki. He's good and bad guys.
Yeah, it's one of those villains where he doesn't do the James Bond arch nemesis describes his entire plan, but when he explains his motivation for doing what he's doing, you can actually see that it makes some kind of sense. You may not agree with him, but you can't argue against the fact that actually he's got a point.
Yeah,
I've heard that a lot about Killmonger. The fact that his story arc, his backstory, makes it actually was probably the most compelling backstory of a Marvel villain to date.
It is, yeah. It's the best written arc for a villain. Because beyond, we've got Loki, who's been overreported on, I think, but beyond that, we don't really have any compelling villains, do we?
No, not in Marvel movies.
No.
Oh, yeah, because DC have loads, don't they? Yeah. there was that person who did that thing, and the one with the hands. That's about as far as you can get.
I'm sorry, but the original General Zod was magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really... That was sort of... It wasn't really in an era where lines were drawn between Marvel and DC. That was just... It's just Superman.
Exactly. They didn't...
It's like the Batman movies by Tim Burton. They were just the Batman movies. They weren't anything more than that. But, I really liked the Black Panther, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing with the Black Panther film is it's not afraid to poke fun at itself. So even when they're talking about Killmonger being the big bad, they're having fun. The other characters have fun with the name as well.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but the Dora Magi, which are basically, they've been brought up on the show before about how apparently they're supposed to be his wives, but no, they're not. Not in any comic that I've ever read.
Was it Dora Milaje or whatever there was?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's words. You only see these words on page. You don't know how to pronounce them.
Yeah, they're basically the kind of brides in training, but it's
they're not.
No, it's. I've got the Black Panther guidebook. They said it's kind of.
They've never been implied as that. They've just been his closest bodyguards.
No, but this is what I'm saying. Their official capacity, historically, the Dora Milaje historically were kind of brides in training, but in the current Wakanda, in the modern Wakanda, they're basically bodyguards, aides-de-camps, that sort of thing.
Hmm. And that's what they've kind of been. The general of them is kind of made very sassy.
Was that Okoye or whatever her name is?
I can't remember. But she's a very sassy character.
The bald one who in the trailers goes Wakanda forever.
The Royal Bald Rob.
Yeah. That is a key feature.
I haven't seen the film.
But yeah, I mean it's not going to be anybody's favourite Marvel movie, I don't think.
I don't know. For me, I think it's gonna
I mean for me it's top three. But for me, I find it much more interesting than like 90% of the rest of, 100% of all the other Marvel movies. Just because of the colour, because of the world it's set in, because of the characters, it's all very unique, whereas all the others are sort of shades of the same thing.
It's also got possibly the most disorientating fight sequences as they're spinning through the air, fighting each other on the way down to that train line.
Yeah.
There's a Hyperloop or something like that they got.
No, they're just spinning through air, but the camera's sort of following them and the landscape, and you're sort of feeling slightly queasy by the time they cut to the main action.
Yeah, I was very close to the screen, but I did have that as well. I did feel that too.
I was really glad I hadn't booked the 3D D-Box version.
Cool.
it's a great film, I think.
And what I would say is, I mean, although you've got that Sins of the Father plotline going through it, I would say it's a better version of Civil War than Civil War was.
Yes, it is, most certainly. Yeah, also, on that, it does cross over with some of the stuff that Ta-Nehisi Coates is doing now. Ta-Nehisi Coates. The Civil War stuff, which does appear, like the Wakanda Civil War does appear in his comic book.
All right, excellent.
So it was nice to see that sort of crossover, yeah.
Awesome. Huh. So,
and also, Batman's basically a poor man, isn't he, compared to Black Panther?
Yes. He's a pauper.
Yeah, but think about it. Bruce Wayne is just a billionaire, whereas T'Challa is a king of an entire
country. One of the richest countries on the Marvel planet, anyway.
Yeah. Basically, Tony goes to bed thinking, dreaming he could be like T'Challa.
Yeah. Yeah, Black Panther.
Yeah, good. Black Panther, if you haven't had the chance to go see it, go see it.
Awesome. On that note, we're taking a break and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, here at The Geek Show, we're a voluntary organisation, so we really appreciate some money from our lovely listeners. And we don't just expect to take your money for free. Want to buy some of our lovely things in The Geek Shop? We have clothes and caps, which are also clothes, but they're different clothes to shirts, which is another item of clothes that we sell. Buy them all now. Consume endlessly.
Good day, I'm Graham Stark.
And I'm Kathleen DeVere.
We're from internet comedy powerhouse Loading Ready Run.
And if you are listening to the radio expecting to hear about butts, you are listening to the wrong show. This is The Geek Show, which is much cooler, but has far fewer behinds.
You're looking for The Butt Show. It's on the other side.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello. We're literally loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
Hello, and welcome back to Four Panels, Black Panther Special. And now to the bit of the show where we review stuff what we've been reading. And first, yes. It's Rob.
Funnily enough, I'm doing Black Panther. And which Black Panther do you want to know? Yes, of course you want to know. It's been titled the book Avengers of the New World, Book One. And this is from Ta-Nehisi Coates with art from Wilfredo Torres and Chris Sprouse. And it's a bit of a misleading title for a book because, you know, Avengers of the New World, Book One, it implies it's the start of a narrative, start of a story arc. What it actually is, it collects volumes 13 to 18 of Ta-Nehisi Coates' run from last year. So it's quite a way into a story. And just what the story is, Wakanda is a country, a isolationist of a country in Africa. Lots of military might, lots of money, just sort of towering over everybody. At the beginning of the series, there's a civil war. I don't really know why, because it's one of these things. It's one of the problems with Marvel, I think, because it has this implication that you got to read everything and know, like, where the world is at that specific point.
Yeah.
So somebody invaded Wakanda at the beginning of this run, and there's a civil war that leaks off from that. There's references to Thanos, so I'm assuming it's some Infinity War thing which inspired that. And so things sort of escalate. Before this, there's a man who gets his power from the mystical beyond. I could call him Tree Man because he could sort of make things move like sort of swamp thingy, but he didn't turn into a green monster. He remained quite human looking.
Yeah, but we have a Tree Man. He's called Groot.
Oh yeah, but he's a normal man, but he can like he can grow wood out of himself.
Oh, right. Tree. Okay. I
think you'll find most men can do that, Rob.
Oh, clever. But that's finished, and the civil war, which I was talking about earlier, has been resolved. And the upshot of that was Wakanda is in this position now, which is, I guess, what the new world of the title is implying. Is it's the era of Wakanda in which they're trying to install democracy, in which I don't know my terms for like. Kind of like what we have. So we've got like a king and a queen, but there's like a government that runs everything.
So basically the monarchy is a figurehead only. It doesn't actually have any political or legal power.
Yeah, he kind of just backs away. That's the whole point of it. He's backing away from a position of power just being a figurehead. And there's struggles there. But a majority of the story takes place around sort of the world being more aware about Wakanda. There's people from the underground, the underworld, who are trying to pounce on the perceived weakness of Wakanda to make a power play and subdue Wakanda under their heel. And to do that, they're employing the Man-Ape again. He plays a rather sizey role in this. And things happen. There's manipulations, there's twists, there's turns, and it's told in a very much a Ta-Nehisi Coates style of way, which is very elaborate, very detail-heavy, and quite politically astute, which feels like it's sort of the tone which Black Panther is going in currently. It does have some action, and there is some crossovers with the Avengers in there. But at the same time, it feels like sort of contractually obligated crossovers, rather than this is a point where this character should be in the story because it makes sense for this character to be in the story, rather than, you know, well, we've got that crossover event, so we may as well get those guys in here so we can do some cross-promotion. You know what I mean, don't you?
Yeah.
I like the vibe of Ta-Nehisi Coates' stuff, but it feels like it's missing that bite. I mean, it's not like a consciousness bite or like an awareness bite. It's just sort of, as a comic book, it feels more tailored towards people who are politically aware rather than people who like, you know, superhero fights. And I think it kind of needs to find a middle point for Ta-Nehisi Coates to work, if you get me. Yeah. But it's enjoyable. It's enjoyable enough. It's well drawn and it's well put together. Yeah. All the characters well put together as well. But end of the day, it's that gap there between a character who's compelling and a character who's entertaining.
It's interesting.
There's just a hole there.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, you know, there was all that brouhaha about that one bad review of Black Panther on Rotten Tomatoes, which for some people was apparently news. It must have been a very slow week in the, you know, for the journalists at that point. But there was the Irish reviewer who said that he didn't like the fact that Black Panther didn't go around punching more stuff and that there wasn't more action. It was too much of a political thriller spy type movie.
No, it's not. It's not a spy type movie in the slightest. But also, there's kind of a mysticalness about this run of Black Panther. And when characters become mystic in the Marvel continuity, they're kind of hard to comprehend because they're talking weird ways.
I don't know. Doctor Strange was fine.
Yeah, but this kind of goes further. I mean, this person goes to like one of the characters in this. I believe it's Black Panther's sister. He goes to she goes to like the beyond a time in the. You kind of go to the area in Black Panther where you meet the Panther, you meet the elders, you meet the previous Black Panthers. His sister goes there and meets a previous, his mother, sorry, who opens the, like, the history is not like a straight line, it's all around us, and teaches her things about the past, and somehow she comes back with weird magic powers. And she talks in mystical language, which is just kind of hard to, like, get your head around as well. So, I mean, I enjoyed it, but it's just kind of a bit too many things at the same time.
I thought whenever they did, like, the mystical stuff in any of these Hollywood movies, they always made them sound like they were in some kind of Shakespearean play with all the these and thous and for as muches and stuff like that. So you like the Ta-Nehisi Coates?
I like him, yeah.
Black Panther and the New Avengers?
And Avengers of the New World.
Sorry, Avengers of the New World. New Avengers was basically John Steed, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm waiting for the inevitable Marvel follow-up, which will be the Black Panther and the Avengers of the all-new uncanny world, or the all-new, all-different world.
See, I can't read Black Panther and the Avengers of the New World because I haven't read Black Panthers and the Avengers of the Old World, you know, and surely you must read that first.
All right, so who's next?
Me, that would be me. I have The Defenders. The Defenders, yes, which is Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and Iron Fist, which is the current run of Defenders from, well, according to Netflix anyway. And it's not like the Defenders that I remember from when I was a kid, which was like Hulk and Doctor Strange and Thor and people like that. Because, no, they must be in the Avengers. You can't have them in two teams. Anyway.
Isn't the Defenders like Avengers Division 2?
No, that was Avengers West Coast. I think you'll find. The team led by Hawkeye.
Right.
you didn't read comics during the 90s. You don't know what we went through, Mick.
That's true. Sounds like it was a dark time.
It was. We suffered. They blacked up Punisher. Anyway, this is written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by David Marquez. And it was interesting. And you'll notice there's a question mark at the end of that statement. Right, this starts off with a guy in a red suit talking to Jessica Jones in her office of Alias Investigative Services, and he's basically telling her about how three psychos attacked a club, and these psychos beat up all the drug dealers who wanted to become the new kingpin, and he wants to send a message to Luke Cage to back off and leave everybody alone, and so he shoots Jessica Jones, who's effectively invulnerable, but he shoots her with a special gun, which kind of goes through her, leaves her bleeding out quite badly. And he says, give Luke my message. And turns out this guy is Diamondback, who is supposed to be dead, you know.
Such a stupid name for a villain, that, isn't it?
Well, the interesting thing about this is that you learn more about the history of Diamondback and Luke Cage. How they used to be best friends until they both fancied this one girl, and she chose Luke over Willis. Willis being Diamondback's real name, and Willis basically lost it. He framed Luke. Luke went to this was back when he was Carl Lucas. He got framed with these diamonds, got sent to prison, and the mob boss who realized that Willis had basically stolen the diamonds and framed Luke, punished him by killing the girl. And so both their lives got destroyed. But Diamondback has always blamed Luke Cage for that. It's apparently his fault and not Diamondback's fault. So he's supposed to be dead, but somehow he's back from the dead. And they spend a lot of time thinking and asking, how are you back from the dead? How aren't you supposed to be dead? And somehow or other, Diamondback has become stronger. As strong as Luke Cage, he can basically throw cars around just like Luke Cage can. He can fight Daredevil and Iron Fist and Jessica Jones. He's got all sorts of abilities, and he also knows their weaknesses. He knows their secret identities. He knows how to hit them and where to hit them. He knows that
he must have that book that Mick has.
Yeah, I think he's got the guide to Ultimate Marvel or whatever it is. And he actually is in a club called Club Ultimate.
See? I stumbled on his secret.
You know, when Jessica Jones comes over and basically hits him in the face, saying because he's basically poisoned Luke Cage, and someone comes along to save Luke Cage, and it's only his old mate, Blade, who, we're talking about Black Panther today, but I just want to throw it out there. Honest Trailers did already point it out, but I just want to remind people, first black superhero in a major Hollywood movie. A lot of people seem to have forgotten that.
Yeah, it's that nobody really cares about Blade.
Yeah.
The first Blade wasn't bad. The second movie was actually really good.
I think it's more of a vampire thing than a superhero thing.
Yeah, but Blade is still a Marvel superhero.
He's a comic book character. He's not a superhero.
Well, that's like saying, you know, Logan isn't a superhero.
No, he is a superhero. He's a hero with superpowers.
Yeah, the difference is, Rob, Blade just goes around murdering people.
So does the Punisher. So does the Punisher.
But he hasn't had a movie, has he?
Yes, he has. He's had three.
Not a good one, Rob. Not a good one. It was a short movie that was all right, but that's about it.
And besides which, the big thing about Black Panther is not just that it's a black superhero, but it's a predominantly black cast and a black director.
This is true. Anyway,
get off your soapbox about Blade and carry on.
I am off my soapbox. I just want to throw it out there. Anyway, back to this. So Diamondback is basically back, and he's having conversations with Black Cat for some reason or other. I don't know why. I'm still not sure about this whole Black Cat kind of not walking that line between good and evil and actually being an out-and-out psycho mob boss type character.
Oh, that's been around for a while, that.
Yeah, no, I'm still not, I still don't like it, you know. Lo and behold, somebody turns up, which throws a spanner in everybody's works, and that somebody is the Punisher, who basically is after Diamondback as well, and he takes out the defenders minus Luke Cage because you know, he's after Diamondback. He doesn't want them getting in the way. He wants to know who's backing Diamondback and how Diamondback is back from the dead. Elektra is also...
You said back a lot there, Rob.
Yeah, I know, because there's a lot of back. there's a lot of back in this. There's a lot of back. There's payback.
Does it have back issues?
Yes, it does have serious back issues. I'm amazed anyone can lift anything in this, you know. And you'll notice when they're lifting cars, they never actually do it right. They don't lift with the knees, they lift with the back. You know, they're going to have serious issues in later life.
Yeah, but to be fair, Good's handling is about as relevant to a Marvel comic as health and safety was to Star Wars.
Yes, I know, but anyway, this actually, I mean, even Damien Hellstrom has a bit in this, which does lead to one funny bit, because when Luke and Damien meet for the first time, he finds out that Damien's actually one of Jessica Jones' exes. And he starts questioning her about that, and she just says, "Do I need to remind you about She-Hulk?" And he's like, no, that was different. That was different, which I thought was a nice little aside. But anyway, this ends in kind of a very brutal way. It has the Defenders wandering around looking for Diamondback, but Diamondback is actually at Black Cat's place. He's broken in, and this ends quite badly for Black Cat. Because Diamondback is a psycho with a gun. I'm actually interested. Bendis does this to me all the time. He comes up with a great first issue, which gets my attention, and then it tails off. But yeah, I'm going to read the rest of it, because I do want to know what happens to Black Cat and how Diamondback is still alive. Anyway, Mick.
Yes, back to Black Panther. And one that I haven't actually quite finished yet, which is odd. Because you guys know me. If I get a good graphic novel,
yeah,
I will lap it up. I will devour it.
Yeah.
The one I did last week, Downward to the Earth. So good. 3 sessions. Done. It was one of those comic books that was so good, you couldn't put it down. Black Panther, Panther's Quest, is so good, you have to put it down.
Okay.
Let me explain.
Good, because I'm confused.
Black Panther is written by Don McGregor, who was one of the key Black Panther writers throughout the 80s.
Yeah.
And it's illustrated by Gene Colan. And it's a run from 1988. And it's about T'Challa receiving information that his up to now estranged mother is alive and in South Africa. But this is 1988 South Africa. This is deep in the era of apartheid.
Yeah.
And it is portrayed so well that Black Panther's mission through South Africa to try and find his mother is so harrowing and brutal, you have to put it down. I would recommend that anybody who reads this run doesn't get too attached to any characters. Half of them are so nasty that you can't get attached to them, and the other half, well, about 80 pages later, if you've got attached to them, you'll be weeping into your pillow.
Ah, one of those, is it?
It's that brutal. So in its depiction of townships and armed forces, gang warfare, internecine fighting between the ruling white minority and the ongoing war between the black township gangs and their elders, all of whom are sort of standing up and saying no more, the infighting amongst the ruling political party, the restrictions on reporting. And then add to that the fact that there have been sightings of a man in a panther suit who has been identified as T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, who is operating in South Africa with no official status, no legal visa application. And it's like he can't walk down the street without finding people who want to fight him.
Wow.
Sometimes it's because he's the Black Panther. Sometimes it's because he's an illegal immigrant. Sometimes it's because he's just black. And that is why it's so difficult to, it's a difficult read. That doesn't stop it being a good read.
This is true.
There are 25 issues collected here, and over the past week, I've managed to get through 20 of them.
Wow.
But it is, sort of drawn to some of the comments Rob made about his Black Panther story, that idea of the political side of it. That's what this is. It's almost like it's a guerrilla documentary that also happens to feature Black Panther, because this shows the South Africa that we never got to see in the 80s, because yeah. The news that the news coverage of events that happened in South Africa were so heavily censored by the government in what news agencies were allowed to distribute, were allowed to show, that we never got the true picture. It was all based on anecdotal evidence from people who'd been out there and witnessed it from them, for themselves.
Yeah.
But this is kind of drawing that picture that we never got, and it is brutal.
I think that's a good role for the Black Panther comic to have. As a, just to go back to the movie, one of the things in the mythology which was a little bit downplayed for the PG audience was it's not just that Wakanda is invisible, it's that anybody who found it was basically slaughtered completely and utterly in defeat. You know, that was softened up a bit. And I think that's the sort of role which Black Panther can have, where it's a little bit more real than other like Marvel comics in the Avengers verse.
I mean, this is one of the things that comes across in Panther's Quest up to now. And bearing in mind that he's been so heavily distracted from his initial quest because he's, as you would expect the King of Wakanda to be, he is quite horrified by what he discovers in South Africa as being the way things are.
Yeah.
He's been completely deviated from his task. But so far, there's been no supervillain. There's been no costumed bad guy. There's been no superior technology that he's got to try and hunt down. There's no mystical stone from outer space that's got hidden powers. This is just man's inhumanity to man that he's facing.
Yeah, there was a similar run when it was done by Reginald Hudlin, but I think that was a bit more recent. It was more about Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Panther just going out there and helping people who he could. There, no fights, no villains. It's just Black Panther trying to be a help.
Yeah.
In a very harsh situation.
See, I think
One of the things that comes across in Black Panther is it's not just that hero thing of I will not take a life. It's the lengths he will go to preserve a life.
Yeah.
Even if that life doesn't appear to be worth saving because it's someone who's tried to beat him to a pulp or set him on fire or thrown tear gas in his face, he will still try and save them if they're in danger.
It's interesting you say that because there were some old Avengers comics that I read where the most human of the Avengers was actually Vision, because Vision was the one going out of his way to save people, whereas the other Avengers were just basically going punching stuff and stuff like that. And I think I've always had a soft spot for more humane characters like this Black Panther you're describing, Mick.
Well, you know, I don't think this is just a Black Panther that is peculiar to this. I mean, taken from the movie and the other bits and pieces. I mean, Black Panther's not one that I've particularly followed over the years.
No,
when he's turned up in other titles, he's been an enjoyable character, but that is...
No, but that's what I'm
saying. That seems to me to be what he is.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I've read Black Panther a lot over the years, and Black Panther is a humane character, more so than the majority of Marvel characters. The weird irony is that Thor is also a very humane character. He loves humans. You know, he wants humans to be all that they can be, which is why he spends so much time on Earth. But you've got the other human characters like Tony Stark, who, you know, doesn't really see people as people.
No, he sees them as assets.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Panther's Quest, collecting issues 13 to 37 of Marvel Comics Presents from 1988. It's a good read, but it's not fun.
Well, not everything has to be fun.
And it's full of gangbangers.
You gotta love them.
Anyway, Rob.
Yes, going back to Reginald Hudlin, one of the things that was established in that is Black Panther is very good friends with Luke Cage.
Yes.
Who he meets as a bodyguard in that, if my memory serves. But in this...
Yeah, I think that's how they met.
Yeah. But in this, it's Luke Cage. It's the 2016 comic. I think that was when it was put out. But this first issue is called Sins of the Father. Again, that was kind of an odd bit of serendipity there. And it's been... written by, it just says Walker everywhere. This is a really bad design cover. David F. Walker, this is by. And the story here is Luke Cage gets news that the person who created him in a lab, the doctor, has died. So he heads down to New Orleans where they're holding the funeral. And pretty much as soon as he gets there, things kind of take a turn for the worse. And he meets Warhawk, who is a fellow... he was the first person who... I can't remember the name of the doctor. It's not important. It's the doctor. He's a doctor. Yeah, but his skin's blue and he's a bit insane.
That sounds like Warhawk.
And what's happening here is there is a... Well, that doctor was a bit mad, really. He didn't just do Luke Cage and Warhawk. He basically turned all of New Orleans into sort of people with impervious skin. Some people did a better job than others. Some people he gave blue skin. Some people who lost their sanity. It's Dr. Noah Burstein. There we go. Thank you, mate. And he has left a bit of a mess. One of the people in particular who is the son of a gangster, he was saved by a very debilitating condition, and in being saved from that, he has this superpower, but he also has this uncontrollable rage. So there's lots of moving parts there. Fundamentally, it's up to Luke Cage, not so much to figure out what's going on, as things just kind of happen, and people turn up, and people die, and it also kind of negates Luke Cage's ability to have, like, unbreakable skin, because they have this, the bad guys have this sword which sort of breaks apart and becomes like a whip. I don't know what you describe that weapon as. Whip sword.
That's a chain sword.
Chain sword, then. Which nearly kills Luke Cage pretty early on.
I think it's called a chain sword. I think these days they call a chain sword basically a sword that's basically just a chainsaw as a sword.
Yeah.
But I think the original chain sword was that.
Yeah, it's an interesting comic in the sense that it's given Luke Cage, like, front and centre. He's always been part of, like, another group, like, and on the Defenders, or as a supporting character in something else, I don't know. He's never really given front and centre.
True.
So it's good that he's got that again. I mean, it does reference his Halcyon days when he was Power Man with that terrible outfit, the yellow T-shirt and the Wonder Woman headband.
And the blue jeans.
Yeah.
With the rolled up bottoms.
It was very 1970s, 1980s.
It was very 1970s.
But my problem with this is it's just not really of much substance.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, it's a comic which is going through the motions. And some of the dialogue is trying sort of very, very hard to be witty. Like, I'm paraphrasing here. Luke Cage says at one point, says, let's just assume that I don't know any of this sci-fi talk that you're going on about. Which I don't. And it's kind of just awkward, tinny dialogue. Like, it's trying to be funny, but it's just completely scuffing every single landing.
Okay.
But, you know, it's Luke Cage. He's got, like, his first lead, so that's good, but the comic itself, it just exists.
Does it have that feeling of being a shameless cash-in on the fact that there's a big new TV show coming out?
Not particularly. It's just kind of empty. It's just like a comic book. You pick it up, you'll read it, you think, that was fun. And then you'll forget you've ever read it.
It's funny because The Defenders does at times feel like a shameless cash-in.
I mean, the art is nice. You know, the story's straightforward enough, but it just doesn't have that thing there, really, to keep you engaged. It just kind of, I mean, it took me about 3 readings to get through a six-issue book. So it doesn't really compel you in any way to continue it on, but it's fine.
Awesome. So, is it me to finish then? Right, bringing us back home on this Black Panther special is yet more Black Panther with Marvel Platinum, the definitive Black Panther. Now, this is an interesting one. This is really interesting to me because this is basically a selection of, just like the other Marvel Platinum stuff we've done, this is a selection of some of the most well-known Black Panther stories that are kicking around. And it starts off with the story that literally started all of them off. Fantastic Four number 52, written in, which was published in July 1966 and written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby. This is the classic issue. This is, the King of Wakanda invites the Fantastic Four to visit his country. And when they get there, they get, into a fight. They are effectively being hunted by the Black Panther. And when the Fantastic Four win, because obviously, you know, he's black in the 1960s, so there's no way he can win. Even though he has been winning so far, ultimately the Fantastic Four must win.
Let's not make this all about race. Let's not also forget that he's just a guest character in their title.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, you know. it's the 60s, you know. But anyway, it turns out that the story isn't as simple as the Fantastic Four thought, because obviously they're upset. But when T'Challa explains the reasons why he's taken on this task, he said, if I could beat you, then I'm prepared to take on our greatest foe. The greatest foe at this point being Ulysses Claw. Now, there is a weird little aside, which is part of a greater story involving the Inhumans and the Fantastic Four, in that the Inhumans are trapped inside a dome somewhere, right? And then, you know, it goes on to Black Panther talking to the Fantastic Four about Ulysses Claw and how he's coming back to get revenge, and how T'Challa basically shot off his hand after Ulysses Claw killed his father in front of him. And so he hates Ulysses Claw, Ulysses Claw hates him. There's never going to be any reconciliation between the two. So the only way left for them both is one of them has to die, which is nice. There's a finality to it which you don't get in modern comics. And I've got to say, Stan Lee's writing does hold up really well to modern language. And Jack Kirby's artwork, it takes a bit of getting used to if all you've read is modern comics, but certain characters drawn by Jack Kirby, you can see how they've evolved over the years.
Yeah, I've also looked at this book, and it just highlights one of the collected issues, I guess you'd call it, that are in that book.
Which one?
It's the one in which... the Kree try to invade Wakanda.
Yeah, I'm leaving that till last. We'll talk about that in a bit. Okay, good. Don't worry, we will be talking about that. But yeah, it goes on from there to others. I mean, just to give you an idea of the titles in this, some of them are a bit odd. So Fantastic Four, and then it goes on to Fantastic Four, because that's number 52 and 53. And then it goes on to The Avengers number 87 from 1971. And then to Jungle Action number 6, which I'm not sure about that name, but then Black Panther Volume 1 number 1, which was January 1977, and this time was written by Jack Kirby. And then Marvel Team Up number 100 from 1980, written by Chris Claremont and John Byrne, which is actually a really good one as well. Then Black Panther Volume 3 number 1 from 1998, written by Christopher Priest and Joe Quesada. Black Panther Volume 3, number 57, written by Jay Torres, and 58, which is also written by Jay Torres. Those are from 2003. Black Panther Volume 4, number 18, from 2006, written by Reginald Hudlin.
It was an amazing run. And also that Christopher Priest one is credited as being one of the best runs with Black Panther.
It is. It is easily one of the best runs. But the Claremont run was very, very good as well, and Kirby's run was particularly eye-opening. So yeah, then we can move on to 2008, Black Panther Volume 4, number 39, written by Jason Aaron. That's 39, 40, 41. And then AVX Versus, number 5, written by Jason Aaron in October 2012. Now, I've only given you names and titles of stuff, but I haven't given you any clues as to what they are. There is Black Panther's first adventure against Killmonger. And Killmonger, to those who don't know, is basically the other bad guy from the movie. You know, where have you been?
Bad guy.
Yeah, what have you been listening to for this entire podcast? We talked about him in the first half. Yeah, so Black Panther's first foray against him. Also, it's kind of it goes into the history of Storm and Black Panther, how they first met and how she helped him out right at the beginning, and how there's always been this kind of weird attraction between the two of them. Which is interesting. It goes on to very weirdly drawn. I mean, they've gone for a more lifelike art style with this one, and I'm not sure about it, but that one was like Black Panther number 57 from whichever year, I've forgotten. And that one has, again, this one reminded me the most of 90s comics, the way they've drawn the characters. Right, this one was Black Panther number 57, and it was Coming to America Part 1 of 2. And yeah, it just reminded me so much of the old 90s Image comics. Just the character designs and the artwork and everything like that just really, really kind of screams Oh, look at us. We, you know, we draw for Image. And so, yeah, didn't really impress me that much. But I think the two big stories in this, aside from the very first Fantastic Four one, there are two other big stories in this. There is the one that Rob's talking about, which is the, it's strange because it is kind of intercut. There's the first bit of it, which, this story happens in between two particular events. The wedding of Black Panther and Storm, which I thought was interesting. Storm has to face the Panther God, and the Panther God accepts her as T'Challa's bride. And Spider-Man or Ultimate Spider-Man or whatever, Iron Spider, gets into a fight with Man-Ape, and it becomes a proper superhero wedding. At that point, Luke Cage is just saying to Jessica Jones, now it's a real superhero wedding because someone's got punched through a wall. Dr. Doom gives his greetings to the happy couple and says, you might want to consider Latveria.
And presumably brings a selection of tasty hors d'oeuvres.
See, this is the thing. Dr. Doom just randomly showing up in this comic was just, it kind of set...
I don't think he randomly shows up. It's part of like an arc where
he was
talking with all the people who weren't like America affiliated.
Yeah, and the thing is, Doctor Doom's visit was actually quite an interesting one because he makes a good point. He's the ruler of Latveria, and T'Challa is the king of Wakanda, and so between monarchs, there should be meeting. He's basically approaching it on the basis that both Wakanda and Latveria are in similar situations. They're both. And he also reminds T'Challa that the people who used to be his friend before may not be his friend in the future, but the people who used to be his enemies before may not be his enemies in the future as well.
He also talked to Captain Underpants, aka Neymar.
Yes. Fish scales, they do chafe. Anyway, that gives way to the Skrull invasion, and oh my god, this is one of the most bloody stories I've seen for Black Panther.
It's why you don't mess with Black Panther.
I love the bit where thing is, when you first see the Skrulls, right, they're in the ship and they're going along, and then the Skrulls actually, if a Skrull could go pale just from the image in front of them, they would, because they get to the border of Wakanda and they see a bunch of Skrull heads on spikes as a clear warning. We know you're there. We know you're coming. Come at us.
Yeah, there's a big part of it where the Skrull, was it? Sorry.
Yeah, the Skrull.
Have basically genetically modified this guy with all like the DNA of all the toughest Avengers for the sole purpose of killing Black Panther.
It's not just the Avengers.
It's all the toughest fighters.
He's got
superheroes and whatever.
He's got Logan's claws, Iron Man's Iron Fist's fist, Bullseye's ability to basically throw things accurately and hit any target and various things like that. He's not the only one that they've made. They've made others as well.
And the way Black Panther just kills him.
Yeah, it just takes him apart.
Yeah. Savage stuff.
Yeah. It is savage stuff. I mean, this Skrull, basically, he rips open one of the Wakandans' chests and uses his rib bones as projectile weapons. Uses two of his rib bones as projectile weapons, which Black Panther, obviously being the cool cat he is, he just catches them out of midair and, he then proceeds to take them apart. How dare you kill my subjects? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it does end with, Storm, who is actually married to him, and she's fighting and killing at the same time because, she's a badass. Let's be fair. She gets captured by a Skrull infiltrator, and so the two of them are captured and tortured by the Skrulls, but there's a double bluff at play, which I'm not going to spoil. That leads us on to the finale, which is X-Men versus Avengers, and that the final issue is literally just Storm versus Black Panther, and the two of them kind of reminiscing about how they could have made things work, they could have done things differently. Maybe if they'd had kids, there would have been more to hold on to, more to cling on to. But he has the problems of being the king. She has the problems of, being her. He's too cool-headed. She's too hot-headed. And even though they really do love each other, they just can't see eye to eye because of what's happening in the world at that point.
Mm.
Which is kind of a sad way to end that. But I think it's kind of the best way to end that particular definitive Black Panther. Because it does... It's very telling. It kind of shows that because he's king, no one else can understand the burden he carries. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, people think Starmer is a goddess. So
yeah, which kind of pissed off the Panther God during the wedding, which I found hilarious. Because the Panther God's going, so she's the one who calls herself a goddess. And so you got T'Challa having to be apologetic and going, no, no, it's just what other people call her. She has no control over what people say.
Yeah.
What you were saying about the Skrull invasion storyline would explain why the one review for this collection on Amazon says, I bought this for my 10-year-old nephew and found that it was entirely unsuitable due to the violence and blood.
Yeah, it does have a bit of violence and blood. Just, he basically snaps his knee by stamping on it.
Yeah.
Doesn't that, that big scree, doesn't he pull his heart out or something?
No, no. What he does, he rips off a chunk of flesh from like his shoulder and then snaps his arm, snaps his knee, and then leaves him in a pool of blood. It's just, yeah, it gets worse from there. I mean, the torture scene was pretty bad as well. But I would, if you're a fan of Black Panther or you want to learn more about Black Panther, there are actually two things I would get, right? If I wanted to learn more about the history of Black Panther, I would get this, Definitive Black Panther, and I would get the Ultimate Guide to Black Panther from DK Books, because those two together will give you a great crash course in the world of Black Panther.
And he's also a good character to get into because he doesn't have like 1,000 different iterations.
No, it's just him.
No, that's not what I mean. It's like every superhero is like 100 different runs for Hulk, Iron Man, Thor.
Well, don't forget, there's always the reboot and the reboot and the reboot, but for him, his story is pretty much the same. Doesn't matter how many times you reboot the universe, his story has been pretty much the same from its origin, hasn't it?
He doesn't have that many comic books to speak of, so he's quite an easy one to get into.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the initial Black Panther story where he invites the Fantastic Four to Wakanda, it really is, it shows its age, because there's one brilliant scene in this, which I do have to mention this. It just shows how old these comics are. The Wakandan envoy, he has come to see the Fantastic Four, and he says, I shall communicate these glad tidings back to the Black Panther at once. And Reed Richards is going, he took out a metal device from inside his toga, but it's so small. Can he truly transmit a message halfway around the globe with that?
Guess you have to be there for that one.
No, yeah. I'm saying that that was the 1960s. Now if we want to communicate halfway around the world, we just pick up the phone, don't we?
You're referencing some, I don't know. So yeah, that's Black Panther, and that's 4-panel, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're done.
So if you want to check out anything on the Geek Show Podcast Network, search us on Google, or head to thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to talk to us over the internet, you can find us on the internet, on Twitter specifically, go to 4-panel podcast and follow us there. But until next time, I've been Rob.
I've been Rob.
I've been Mick.
And thanks for listening.
Goodbye.